Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You know you have to do it every evening or outsource it to someone else, but making dinner can alternately fill you with mouth-watering anticipation or dread for the mundane and frustrating task that lies ahead. That often depends on your schedule, culinary expertise, and how much appreciation you're likely to get from whomever you're cooking for. But there are ways to make sure that most, probably not all, but most of your dinner cooking experiences are pleasurable and fit with your dietary needs and your schedule. Known for her award-winning books on braising and roasting, Williston-based food writer Molly Stevens has a new book out all about dinner. That's what it's called, All About Dinner. And she starts by revealing that for years, she felt a slight aversion to answering when her students asked her what she cooked for herself at home. Too personal, she felt. But upon reflection, what our elevated food writers actually make for themselves and their families is probably a good indicator of how we can cook well for our own selves and families. And so Molly Stevens' new book is more vegetable, salad, and soup focused, and it emphasizes flexibility and basic skills. So, you ready for dinner? Today on the show, we're going to talk with Molly Stevens about how to be better cooks and how to release ourselves from guilt to get to better and more pleasurable mealtimes. Molly Stevens, it's such a nice treat to have you back on the show. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So can you tell me about your mother and her expression of love through food? You dedicate the book to her.
I do. So we grew up around the table. I mean, we were not a restaurant family, and we went out twice a year. We went out for Mom's birthday and for Mother's Day. And I come from a very big family, cousins and aunts and uncles, and we would gather around the table for holidays, and there were six of us in my immediate family, and so every night there was a dinner on the table, and it was hectic and crazy, but every night, and it was scratch cooking. It was, there was some convenience foods thrown in there, but it wasn't about the food. I didn't grow up with any sense of gourmet, or I didn't even know what that word meant. But it was just that activity together as a family. And we would actually remember going, it was torture when I was a teenager. You go around the table and have to say what you did that day, something that happened to you, and you just, ugh.
But now you remember it fondly.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And do you think your mother was feeling love every day as she was cooking for the family? Or where was that expression of love, if not in just the way you outwardly feel as you're scrambling to get dinner on the table?
Yeah, it certainly was a scramble. I remember a lot of nights, and that's partly how I got into it, because we were recruited, and it was, gender roles were strict, and my mm-hmm. sister and I were recruited in the kitchen to help with dinner. But it was, everybody was very busy in the household, and so there was a lot of coming and going, and so that's how I remember it as an expression of love, because it was a place for us to connect and to share and to be together. And it was really the only time of day. Even breakfast was on the fly, or not everybody was together. And certainly people weren't home at lunch. And so dinner was the one time of day that we were all together.
You know, when I think about how I cook and how I feel about cooking, I think for the early parts of my adult life, cooking was an expression of love, and often of self-love, of this idea that I can cook for myself and both feed my body and make sure that it's doing what it needs to do to function, but also explore these flavors and ideas and spend time really enjoying what I was doing in the kitchen. And sure, sometimes romantic love as well, when you have a partner who you want to cook for. Right. As a parent now, I want to be expressing parental love through food and through cooking, but it is really hard. And that's where a lot of the guilt comes in. And in this book, you're saying you shouldn't feel guilty about how you cook or what you need to do to put food on the table. But how do you sort of preserve that feeling of love, but also give yourself a break, whether you're cooking for kids or just trying to, eat between shifts at work or whatever it is that you need to do to make sure that you're both enjoying food and also fueling your body.
Right. And this is not, and be clear, this is not a book for, working parents with little kids. And I'm not saying it's not for them, but that's not who it's designed for.
Right.
I often think one of my great inspirations in when I was working on this book over the past 6 years, I have a niece and her husband who live in Baltimore, and they have three girls under age of five. And there are two of the recipes in particular in this book that I actually developed with them. They went, they tested for me. We worked back and forth. And they're both sheet pan suppers, and which is, you know, everything on one quickie sheet and bake it. But I've talked to her at length about how she sometimes feels like a failed parent because sometimes regularly dinner – she and her husband will eat dinner after the kids have gone to bed. You know, she just gives up on trying to wrestle everybody together. And so, you know, that's her way into retaining some joy around the table. So I get it that it's not, you know, I don't have young kids at home. So it's easy for me to say that, you know, cooking is calming and I love to, you know. But so I'm very aware that everybody's challenges are different around the kitchen.
But actually, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed in reading through this book. And I haven't cooked anything from it yet, but I have some ideas of, you know, what can I make this weekend that are not fussy and involved, but they look like they're going to be beautiful, delicious meals and ones that I can enjoy making and perhaps learning some new skills. And so you offer, you know, here's how you can do this. But if you already know how to blanch your green beans, you don't have to read about how to blanch them. But if you don't know how to blanch, you know, I'm going to give you some skills and some tips. And so it's sort of a nice way to be able to read through and think about skills, but also look for what might be fast and efficient to do. I mean, you even have a grilled cheese recipe in here.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a lot of fast and efficient things and a lot of that sort of permission that dinner doesn't have to be a meat and potatoes three courses. You know, it's just something that you're making. And if there are shortcuts, I could tell you, you know, I offer those up and ways to work arounds and, you know, permission to make it your own.
All right. So give us your tips on the grilled cheese then. We'll start with that one and then we can go more involved.
So the grilled cheese is a tip that's been around for a few years now. And I first learned it from a chef out of New York City, Gabrielle Hamilton, in her book. But it's to, instead of using softened butter on the outside of the bread, to use mayonnaise. And a couple of reasons for that. One, if you don't have softened butter, and grilled cheese is often something you're making on the fly, and so you've got to wait to soften the butter, well, or if you try to take the butter and it's not soft, you're going to rip up the bread. So spreading mayonnaise is a brilliant tip, and it works, actually browns it a little more slowly so you can cook the grilled cheese more slowly, because that's the key to a great grilled cheese, is to take the time so the bread gets really nice and crusty and the cheese gets nice and gooey on the inside.
I know, we shouldn't have this show at mealtime. It's a really bad thing. Okay. Yeah, and you also say, you know, you want to use a cheese that is going to melt well, but I liked your idea of maybe grating in some of the harder cheeses. So you're not going to want to use a Parmesan, for example, as
right.
your base cheese, but you might grate some in and give it that extra sort of bite and tang. In
exactly.
The flavor.
Yep.
Molly, you also brought cookies in today, and I've eaten half of mine, so I'm staring longingly at the other half. But you said these are not exactly the cookies from your book. So how do they illustrate what you're trying to do in your book?
Right. So there's a brown butter hazelnut shortbread cookie in the – there's a dessert chapter, sweet snacks and desserts at the end of the book. And I thought it'd be fun to bring some cookies today because, you know, you show up.
Who doesn't want cookies?
You cookbook author, you show up with something to eat. So, and of course, last night I went to make them and I realized I didn't have any hazelnuts in the house. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to run out and buy hazelnuts because I don't have
time
for that.
What, we're not worth it?
No, but I had some walnuts and I thought, well, I'd rather use up the walnuts. I loved it. So I just switched around the recipe. And which that's one of the things that has been really fun since the book comes out. So I get calls from people and they say, well, I made this dish, but I didn't do this. I did this, this, and this instead. And to me, that's just the essence of it, to feel that a recipe is open to interpretation and that it's going to work even if you completely disassemble it, it might not. But if you follow the spirit of it but make it your own, to me, that's really the joy of cooking.
And you have pages that are sort of devoted to that. I'm thinking about your grain bowls, for example. You have recipes. So, you know, here's a bowl that you can make for a really nice grain bowl or a really nice skillet pasta, as you call them. But then also, here's how you can just do whatever you want. You know, there's some basic skills that you need, and then it's open to interpretation.
Right, exactly. And I tried to do – I understand that there are two kinds of cooks. There's some cooks who love to follow a recipe and be very prescriptive, and then there's others who like to go off on their own. And for me, really, that leap into going off on your own is really – it's exciting. It's empowering. It's like, I'm cooking now. I'm not following a recipe. And it's really hard to – I can't do it, to read a page and to cook at the same time, to go back and forth. It's hard to do that. And when you're really free from the page, all sorts of things happen, open up possibilities for inspiration, and also you really start to pay attention to what's happening and how your actions are creating reactions, and you know, you're more attentive to the heat levels and the seasonings and everything. So what I really wanted to do was to offer, like you say, there's a recipe for pasta with chard and sausage, but then following that are a couple pages on the basic, you know, idea behind the dish and how you could take the idea and make it your own.
You also have at the beginning, what do you call them, 15 tips of highly efficient cooks or
the
something?
Habits, stealing,
yeah, the 15 habits.
Stephen Covey, yeah.
And one of them is to read the recipe twice before you start anything.
Right.
Why? Why twice? I mean, just read it once. Get moving.
So every recipe is a roadmap, and when you're cooking, if you are a proficient cook and you don't need a recipe, you know in your mind where you're going. You have a sense of, like, you know, you're driving in the car and you're going home. You go to the same place. You know where you're going. Same thing. So if you read it once and you read it again, then you have in your mind a sense of where it's going to go. So you're not surprised along the way. I think that timing is a real challenge for cooks when they're getting started, is like having two things going on at once. And so – and the other thing is – the reason you read it twice is many recipes hide steps. So say there's an onion and it's chopped, but you just see it says one onion, and you get halfway through and you need to add the onion and it hasn't been chopped yet. So it's going to slow you down and throw off whatever else is happening. So it's just looking for those hidden steps.
Yeah, I wind up finding myself reading a recipe and thinking, I got this. And then I get, you know, 6 or 7 steps in reading it and think, oh, no, I don't have time for that.
Right, right.
What are the other tips that you offer people for what they should be thinking about as we begin?
So I feel like they kind of are, rather than going through all of our 15, but they're almost in two categories. It's sort of a sensibility, a framework, a way to approach food and to approach cooking with a sense of enjoyment and also a sense of attentiveness. And it's kind of the more you enjoy it, the more attentive you are, the better cook you become, and then the more you enjoy it. So it's a cyclical thing that the more you do it. And then there's also some very practical tips in there, and it's to appreciate three in particular: salt, acid, and fat, and how those three elements really, really getting a handle on those, knowing how to use those, knowing how to add them, when to add them, can improve your cooking just tenfold.
Yeah, I remember hearing the adage, wait to salt until the end so you don't have too salty of a dish. But you say, no, you should salt early and often.
Salt early and salt often, and you actually will end up, in most cases, adding less salt, because if you're waiting to salt at the end, you're adding it. It's going to be this overlayer, but really salt, not only does salt season our food, but salt brings out flavors. So, you know, when you salt, we talked about eggplant before, if you put salt on a piece of eggplant, what happens? You have these little droplets of water. Well, that action is actually happening whenever you're adding salt. So if you're making a soup and you put a sprinkle of salt in at the beginning, and there's some carrots and some onions and some garlic, and it's bringing out the moisture and all those flavors are, it's like getting the party going. Everybody's so a little bit at a time. So at the end, hopefully the dish will be well seasoned, well balanced. It will taste like the ingredients, but it won't taste salty.
We need to talk about eggplant, because you and I had that conversation before we started
right on
air. And I was telling Molly that in reading the cookbook yesterday, I got really excited about these. Do you call them eggplant rolls?
I think I call them eggplant roll-ups.
Eggplant roll-ups. I really love eggplant, but I'm not very experienced in cooking it. And this seemed like a pretty easy sort of gateway approach to eggplant, but also not super heavy, not like an eggplant parmesan that I'm familiar with eating in restaurants. So what is this recipe?
Right. And so it's a technique that I use a couple times in the book with eggplant, and that the challenge of cooking eggplant is that it soaks up so much oil. And so instead of frying it, I brush it with oil and then broil it. And so it doesn't cook as evenly or as luxuriously, you know, velvety as when you fry it, but it makes it tender enough and flavorful enough that then I roll it around a ricotta based filling
with spinach and
seasonings, and then line them up in a pan with a little bit of crushed tomato on the bottom, sort of like just a very simplistic tomato sauce, and a little more sauce on top with some cheese. So it's almost a lasagna eggplant parmesan mix up. But that trick, and I also do that eggplant. You could do it on the grill, certainly in the summertime, but under the broiler works as well. And I'll make an herb salad and just take those eggplant planks, I call them, or rounds that have been grilled or broiled, and then just pile an herb salad on those as well. It's just it's just a lighter way to enjoy eggplant. I love eggplant.
And the eggplant roll-ups, I mean, it looks like they're pretty thin, so it might be difficult on a more difficult, it seems like, on a grill to be able to get them up and off unless you've really greased up your grill well. But in the broiler, it seems pretty easy because you grease the cookie tin or whatever.
Exactly. Just line them up on the cookie tin and flip them over once. And yeah, exactly.
And you even have a sort of an augmentation or a difference that you can do in that dish, which you said, I think, you know, use a jar of or a tin of canned tomatoes if you want the sort of chunkier, lighter tomato flavor, or you could use tomato sauce if you want it to be more like sort of a lasagna type based, or, you know, that sort of saucy rather than chunky.
Right. And the straight up tomatoes, canned tomatoes, or even you could even use a chopped fresh tomato, would give you a lighter, brighter flavored casserole, really. But then if you have tomato sauce that you've already made, or maybe you just bought a jar of tomato sauce that you like, you could use that too, and it would be a heavier, meatier flavor, you know, a more complex flavor.
Let's go to Derek, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Derek. Go right ahead.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking my call.
What are you wondering about?
Well, recently our daughter has just transitioned to being a vegetarian, and I have a pretty strong cooking background, and I've worked in the food and beverage industry for years, but I'm just kind of looking for some ideas. She suffers from acid reflux, which is kind of what pushed her to want to try a vegetarian diet, as it's, you know, some meats and proteins can really agitate that. And so I'm just wondering about some quick ideas. Like, she loves quesadillas and black beans and everything, but it's a bit much for her every night. It's the same thing. She's a little bit over it. So looking for some quick, fun ideas.
For vegetarian?
Yeah. And we're doing eggplant parm tonight, so it was great just hearing you talk about eggplant.
What a coincidence. All right. So, Molly, what about these vegetarian options for a 10-year-old and thinking about how to go either mostly vegetarian or all vegetarian and sort of both get what you need in terms of protein, but also what you need in terms of flavor and excitement.
Right. So beans are – I'm a huge –
You're on a bean crusade.
I'm on a bean crusade. Get people, but beans, and certainly canned beans, but dried beans, you just get so much more variety available to you. And a good pot of beans is a great place to start. And if you make a good pot of beans, and there's a recipe in the book called A Good Pot of Beans, and then having those on hand, there's a bean gratin that you can make with them. There's you could certainly, you know, rice and beans. There's also grains. The variety of whole grains out there right now is really exciting. It's one of the most exciting things that's happening. And so grain bowls are a great place to start. And there's in creating a grain bowl, so you say the grain is quinoa, and then maybe there's some roasted broccoli that goes on top of it. If you have that pot of beans, you could add some beans and then a simple dressing, either could be a vinaigrette style or maybe a tahini-based dressing. And you have those various elements that give you a combination of flavors and textures that create an entire meal and plenty of protein.
Yeah, and you talk about that in that grain bowl section, that you want to make sure you have at least a couple different kinds of vegetables, and you advise not going too heavy on the raw vegetables lest it become a salad, which is also a good option, but not the same thing.
Right. And you want that, and so much, and I talk about this in a couple different sections in the book, but so much of cooking or putting together a dish is thinking about how the flavors go together, but also how the textures. And I think then that's where, you know, cooking with vegetables is so exciting, because you do have all these different textures. And you know, you talk about raw vegetables, and raw vegetables going to give you a certain texture, and then a roasted vegetable is going to give you a different texture, or a blanched vegetable, or maybe something pickled. You know, if you make some quick pickles and keep them in the refrigerator, or just, you know, carrots and radish or something, and add a few of those on top, then you get this crunchy thing. So that quesadilla that Derek's making for his daughter, you know, if you put just some quick pickled carrots or onions on it, suddenly it's more exciting. It's got another layer of flavor and texture.
And I will say, in our house, my 3-year-old loves anything pickled. And so we do a lot of pickled, very thinly sliced pickled onions, just red onions, because if you have a nice jar, you know, we just use our ball jars, but we have a couple that are beautiful jars. And if you put some onions sliced thinly that are red onions into a jar. They just look so beautiful that even though it's quick, it doesn't do anything in terms of, you know, the actual flavor of it to have it in a nice jar. It just makes me happier when I pull it out and it's like, look at this beautiful jar of pickled onions that we have.
I love it. And there's, in the back of the book, there's a Scratch Basics chapter and have a number of my favorite pickles. And I say it's like having money in the bank when you open up your refrigerator door and there's, you know, three jars of beautiful pickles all lined up that you made. And it's great.
So is it okay then to do what my mother taught me when I was little, although she'll hate me for saying this, but that if you have a jar of pickles that you bought at the store and you finish them, then you just throw your carrots in it and it's you're brining your carrots in your jar of store-bought pickles?
I have never heard that, and that's brilliant, and I'm going to try it.
I mean, it works.
Not?
Yeah, reuse
that
pickle brine.
I reuse the brine from pickles that I make, so why wouldn't it work?
All right, good. So stamp of approval. Tyler says, one of our standby dinners for our family of six is rice and beans. Black beans with sautéed onions seasoned with cumin and salt. We top it with salsa, sour cream, cheese, whatever else we have. The kids love it, and it's fast, cheap, and filling. Molly, I think you'd probably like that meal. And cumin is one of the spices, I think, that you say in the book is actually really good to have on hand to grind yourself.
Absolutely. Tyler, that sounds fantastic and is something we eat a lot as well. And yeah, so I really do. One of those habits is about buying your spices, keeping your spices fresh. And if you can buy them whole and grind them yourself. And I know it's a lot to ask. And, you know, if you're baking an apple pie to grind cinnamon sticks, I mean, let's be realistic. I mean, you certainly could do that and more power to you. But so what I did is I identified the spices, sort of my top few spices that I think you really get a big bang if you do buy them whole, toast them if you even have the extra couple of minutes and then grind them. Mm-hmm. And cumin is one of those. And just toasted cumin and then grind it yourself is just like, power flavor.
I was a little disappointed to see that because cumin is one of my favorite spices to cook with, and I was hoping that you would say, "No, it's fine. Buy it powdered." But I love it so much that I'm like, "Oh, if it could be even better if I ground it myself, I might have to do that."
Jane, what I would say is have both,
mm-hmm.
and some days, most days, you got the ground, go with the ground. But the days when you're just a little bit quieter, you got VPR classical on, you're in a little bit of a take a moment and just toast it. Just see. And the other thing I do with cumin a lot, too, is I know we add it at the beginning, especially with beans and things like that and stews, but I'll take some of that toasted cumin and coarsely grind it and then at the end of cooking just to
– like a finishing spice?
Yeah, like a finishing spice just to scatter a little bit over at the very end. And it's just like, wow, boom.
Hmm. Yeah. Is it just that sort of punch of flavor?
A punch of flavor, yeah. And I first did it with a lamb, a lamb shoulder that I slow cooked, and I made a cumin salt. So I took the cumin and ground it with some salt and then sprinkled that over the end. And then I've just started to take the salt out of it because it doesn't necessarily need it. Hmm. And it's just, again, another layer of flavor, a little bit of a finish.
Speaking of salt, you have some tips. You use kosher salt in your cooking. You like the texture, the sort of a little bit thicker but not super big, but also it's easy to use. And then you also have some other kinds of finishing salts that you use.
Yeah, I really learning how to salt or getting comfortable salting is goes a long way into improving your cooking. And kosher salt makes it so much easier because the grains are bigger. And so you're less apt, especially if you're salting early and salting often, the way I hope cooks do, with table salt, super fine table salt, it's really easy to tip the balance too quickly, but kosher salt, because it's bigger, it also absorbs more easily. Foods absorb it more easily, and it doesn't stick to your fingers as much as well, which our hands are always often a little wet in the kitchen. So that's my workhorse, everyday salt. But then I love having a few finishing salts, which are the bigger, coarser grain salts to put on something at the end so you get a little crunch. And so I'll put that. There's a – on desserts as well sometimes. I mean, I didn't put them on these cookies, but sometimes I'll put them a little bit of a flaky salt on top of some chocolate toffee or something, and then you get that sweet and the bitter mm-hmm. and that crunch.
And so how many finishing salts do you have in your pantry now?
Well, people tend to give them to me too as gifts. So
more than you want.
At breakfast this morning, my husband said, here's your fancy salt.
We got a note from Irene who says, I love, love, love Molly Stevens' books. I use All About Roasting and All About Braising so often. What great recipes and reference books. The tip for salt rub on protein 24 hours in advance of cooking has changed my whole approach to roasting. So speaking of salt, that's been working for Irene.
Oh, yay, Irene. That's awesome.
We also got a tip from Pat VT for a three-day chicken who writes, roast a chicken and have it for dinner. Save the fat in pan, add some water, scrape off the stuck parts, pour it off, and refrigerate. Save the leftover chicken. Toss the bones in a pot and make a stock. Day two, remove the fat from the refrigerated gravy and add a thickener. Stir often. In another pan, cook onion, cabbage, and then add a carb and eat leftover chicken, veggies, and carb with the gravy. Day three, use broth and add a carb to thicken. It's best to cook it separately until nearly done. Add a chopped onion, celery, garlic, and carrots to make soups. Meals for everyone to be happy all week. Now, you and Pat, I think, have similar ideas. You may differ on your techniques exactly, but Molly, I think there's this idea that you can make one meal go a long way. You can use it in different ways. And you also say it's great when you have the time to make your own broth. And if you don't have the time, that's also fine. Use stock broth or use water. But this idea that what Pat, I think, is getting at, too, of just, you know, do what you can in the kitchen. Use the things that you have to make the things that you're going to want to eat.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's wonderful. And I love the saving the fat thing. It's in the I think it was in the roasting book. I have a section on gleaning fat. And you know, there are all these flavorful fats, and when you cook roasted chicken, and there's this fat in the pan, and I've seen people just toss it out. But that's good fat that you can use for something else. And so I love that he's, you know, used that and incorporated it into a sauce the next day. It's great.
Do you have to think about the flavor profile, though, of what you're going to cook with that? Because if you've been cooking in a pan and there's fat, but there's also the seasonings you used, then you have to make sure that you're making something else that's going to taste good with those seasonings, right?
Absolutely. And fat does. I mean, so many flavors are fat soluble, and that's why fat plays such an important role in a lot of our cooking. So you certainly do want to think about what direction it's going. Yeah.
Listeners, what questions do you have for Molly Stevens? 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or I'm sort of cheating here and asking you to tell me what you make for dinner so I can get some good dinner ideas, although I've got a lot now that I need to make from Molly's book All About Dinner as well. You can post your dinner tips on the VPR Facebook page or by writing to vermontedition@vpr.org. One of the things that you say in this book that I had never really thought about was that you might want to think about recalibrating your oven. Now, I have not done it myself, although I know I probably should have a thermometer inside my oven to see what my actual oven temp is. But I sort of feel like, I'm lazy. I'm just going to cook it until it's done. I'm going to, you know, stick the toothpick or stick a fork because I don't even have toothpicks. So stick the fork in and see how it is, or put the instant read thermometer in if I'm, you know, making a roast dinner or something. But you said, actually, you might want to think about if your oven is consistently off by more than a few degrees, calling somebody in to recalibrate. Why do you think that's a better idea than just sort of winging it and maybe cooking it for a little longer or a little shorter than the recipe suggests?
Well, now that I'm hearing you say this, I'm thinking that about my own oven that is – I have two ovens, and one is – they're very different. They cook very differently, and I've never had anybody recalibrate my oven because I think that – and one of the things I say is you really get to know your heat source, and I think that's really more important. And if you're the kind of person who – and maybe it's a Vermont thing. We don't call people to the house to fix things unless it really doesn't
work. Well, I think
it's
a 2020 thing too. It's like who does that kind of handiwork anymore?
Who would you get to come, yeah, right? So it really – more importantly, I think, is to like put that thermometer in your oven so you have a sense of what's going on, or just get – think of it like grilling. When we grill – and not just walk away, set the timer and walk away, or we shouldn't. We're much more in tune. We're like paying attention. And I sort of think that too often we think you put something in the oven, you set a timer and you walk away. But it's not you should have a sense of what's going on in there. So it's really more about knowing, and certainly recalibrating your oven if it is terribly off would probably make your life easier.
So. You also say, yes, use the convection feature in your oven if you have one.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Always.
I mean, there are a few exceptions. If you're cooking something at a very low temperature or something very delicate, usually. But You know, convection is just a way that heat transfers. And when you, you know, you look at a radiator, the waves above the radiator, the air is moving. And mm-hmm. so when you turn your oven on, the air starts to move. And if you turn the convection fan on, you're just making your oven more efficient. And it's especially useful if you're doing something where you're opening the oven door and checking it because
which is what I do all the time.
Well, because your oven's off. So you're not sure how hot it is in there.
But right.
So convection will help it when you open the oven door, all the heat dumps out. If the convection's on, it's going to get hot, maintain its temperature a little bit better. And also, especially when you're roasting anything and you're looking for all those, you know, brown, crisp edges and, you know, getting everything cooked nice and handsomely caramelized, the convection's going to help that happen more evenly. So it heats your oven more efficiently, so you do need to adjust the temperature.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and you have that in the recipes. You have the convection and non-convection temperature.
Exactly.
But basically
– and in this book, I put the convection first because I really think if you've bought an oven in the past 15 years, it's probably got a convection feature. And so many people don't use it, and it just it really helps.
And if you're cooking with convection, you reduce the temperature from the conventional temperature by about 25 degrees, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes, yes.
Let's go to Ethan calling in from Windsor. Hey, Ethan.
Hi. Thanks for having this program on. I wanted to talk about a recipe that I learned about a couple of years ago in a cookbook when I was doing the Whole 30. So it's egg roll in a bowl. And what you do is essentially take a couple bags of like coleslaw mix. So like cabbage, chopped onion, carrot, and then you kind of, I'd like to put in some garlic with like some sesame oil and a little bit of olive oil sometimes. And you can add like some whatever protein you want. And it makes a lot of food that's really filling, but it's also like really low in carb and you feel really good after, at least I do. And it just like you can take like some mayo with like a little bit of like hot sauce or like a sriracha and make kind of like a spicy mayo that goes on it nicely. And it's super easy, about a half an hour, and makes great dinner on the go. So,
Ethan, thanks for that suggestion. And you might be interested. Molly actually has a recipe for making your own mayonnaise. And is at pains to say, you know, if you've got a jar of mayonnaise and you want to use it, great. But also, here's how you can know how to make your own mayonnaise. And Molly, one of the things that you say is a little bit of scratch cooking of those basics, making your own crackers, making your own mayonnaise, just helps you understand food better and be in more control over what you're putting in your body.
Right, and you're just more connected to it in a nice way and in a way that you learn. But it's not a – you know, it's not, I have jars of mayonnaise in my refrigerator, and sometimes that's what I use, and other times I'll make my own. You know, it's just really what you have time for and what you're in the mood for.
In fact, you say in your grilled cheese sandwich you usually use your store-bought mayonnaise.
Yeah.
So Matt, our producer who's on the other side of the glass from you, has a question. When I brine a protein like pork or turkey, the gravy I make is usually really salty. Is there any way to avoid that? I usually brine in a salt and sugar solution, he says.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Dilution is the way to use a little bit of those cooking liquids, but then use something that's not brine-based.
And here's a question for me. You peel your asparagus?
I love peeled asparagus, the big fat ones. I know it's a total luxury thing. It's crazy. But just to have nothing between me, my teeth, and the pure pleasure of that plump asparagus.
And do you peel the whole thing or just the woody part at the bottom?
Just the bottom up until where the spears really start to head. So it's – I trained in France. What can I say?
I mean, it sounds great.
And I don't do it all the time, but boy, when I do, there's just an extra, extra level of enjoyment.
Well, I was eager to learn that tip as well as many others in the book. The book is called All About Dinner, Simple Meals, Expert Advice. And the author of the cookbook is Molly Stevens, who is a cookbook author, a food writer, cooking enthusiast and specialist for hire as well. Molly, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jane. It's great.